Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The year-end holidays inspire many people to reach out to those who are less fortunate. Now social media has created entirely new ways of making a difference. For example, here's a YouTube video from a charity to help classroom teachers called DonorsChoose.org.
How can a future architect use this broken ruler? How can a future musician use this guitar? Or an artist make the sun shine without colored crayons? When you visit DonorsChoose.org, you choose what items you want to give. Whether it's rulers, guitars, crayons, or books, your donation allows kids to realize their dreams.
Of course, that was actor Morgan Freeman explaining how donors can go online to provide books or musical instruments or a field trip for a classroom anywhere in America. Joining us to talk about online charitable giving are our regular social media commentators and co-founders of Mindset Digital, Betsy Hubbard. Betsy, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here, Ann.
And also Deborah Jasper. Deborah, welcome back.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be back.
So until relatively recently, we pretty much waited for the donor request to arrive in the mail, which they still are doing, some of them, usually after Thanksgiving. They really start rolling in fast and before year's end for the tax deduction. So how has social media and the internet changed all of that?
Yeah, doesn't Deborah? That seem quaint? I mean, you think about it. These days, I'm not even paying my bills online, so it's rare for me to go get my checkbook, write a check, put it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and it's a lot easier for me to give money online, and we're much more comfortable with that. You know, 10 years ago, not many of us were giving money online. Today, the majority of us are doing a lot of charitable giving online. More than 60% of 60%.
Yeah, 65% of donors are now giving money online. So it's the fastest growing area of charitable contributions.
It's a younger donor that's doing it online necessarily or not?
You know, it's not limited to the young. Mm-hmm. But what we do know is that first-time donors often choose to donate online. So for nonprofits that are trying to increase their donor base, you know, mounting online campaigns make a lot of sense.
And it's easy in a lot of ways, you know. You can give money easier than writing that check and putting it in the envelope and taking it down to the post office. It's much easier to say, hey, I want to give money this way. A friend of mine got married last year, and she asked all of us, instead of buying her yet another dish or, you know, another thing that she really didn't need, to give money for Habitat for Elephants in Africa. And so we went on her website, because weddings now have websites and are at, you know.
And she could post the links right
and
there.
And she posted the links and said, I'd like for you to give here in my name. And we all did. And I thought that was really brilliant and a great way to celebrate a cause.
My guests are Betsy Hubbard and also Deborah Jasper. They're the co-founders of Mindset Digital. We have them on every week to talk about social media. If you have a question or comment, today we're talking about charitable giving online. So give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you have a good idea for that. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go onto our Facebook page. You can tweet at Ann Fisher, WOSU, if you want as well. So what sort of difference do we know that this has made to charities?
Yeah.
Have they seen an uptick necessarily, or is it just they're just holding on?
Well, here's what we know. I mean, it is a mixed channel world. So charities, like every other organization, they have to pursue multiple
both.
Channels.
Right.
Right. So this isn't one or the other. You know, often cases it's both. So it's true that nonprofits really ignore the online space at their peril. But the online space allows new kinds of connections to be made between donors and the causes they care about. And I think you see that in a lot of the online fundraising that's going on. So, for example, DonorsChoose.org. That's a powerful and different kind of model, because what's happening is individual teachers are recognizing, you know, in my classroom, I need 3 ring binders, or I need an easel or poetry books or dictionaries. And before, you know, maybe they could appeal to their PTA to give them those kind of supplies, but they didn't have many other options. Now teachers can go to DonorsChoose.org and register their project. Now donors choose vet the projects. So, you know, as a donor, you can feel secure that these are really, truly projects, that the money you give is going to go directly to this very specific project and make your donation. So one of the things that we're seeing is that in this day and age, people like to feel like they are making very specific choices about where their funds are going.
That reflects who they are.
That reflects who they are. And so the internet has made that more possible. And you see that in a wide range of organizations. One of the things that's great about Donors Choose is you can also give a gift card. So for this holiday season, you know, you could give somebody a gift card and they could go on and find the classroom of their choice. So right now, for example, there's 38 classrooms in Franklin County that have Donor Choose projects online. And it's a great gift-giving idea.
Yeah, it really is. And you think about, I mean, you're seeing people increasingly, like there are banks who are doing Facebook pages and saying, vote on where you want us to do our philanthropy. Vote on the projects that you think are most deserving. So people are getting engaged in this in lots of different ways. Even if you don't have the money to complete to donate to a project, you can go on and vote and say, I think this project really needs help. And I bought cold medicine last week because I had a cold, and the cough medicine said, if you go to our Facebook page and like us, we'll donate a dollar to a particular charity. And then they're saying, spread your goodwill, not your cold, which I thought was really funny. Mm-hmm. But you're just seeing a lot of that. You're seeing people get to weigh in on how money is being spent on nonprofits in lots of different ways.
Let's listen to the YouTube video for Heifer International, in which Food Network chef Alton Brown, lots of celebrities involved, I imagine, explains how the charity helps poor families in developing countries.
Hi, I'm Alton Brown, and I used to have a goat. Where did my goat go? Well, it went to a family who really needed it, just like the heifer cow I used to have and the water buffalo, which was really too big for my place anyway. Now, why send livestock? Why not say tractors? Because giving an animal is like giving someone a small business. All that wool, the milk, the eggs turn into income for medicine, school, clothing, a better home, a sustainable livelihood.
So Heifer International has been around since the 1940s. It's a survivor no matter what. It was the concept itself is kind of unusual still to a lot of people. But the charity has made really effective use of social media to reach donors and communicate their mission of sustainability. And, you know, to what extent do those videos help?
Oh, I was just going to say, isn't it great that they're telling these visual stories? And the lead is really good. I used to have a goat and a water buffalo, which doesn't fit in my house. I mean, people are doing a really good job of using humor to get attention because that, you know, increasingly it is hard to get our attention in this world. We've got 100,000 words coming at us every day, and that's just outside of work. So nonprofits, the smart ones, are understanding that visual storytelling is powerful, humor is powerful, casual is powerful. So instead of those formal letters that come to my house that can be very easy to ignore, getting my attention in this way is really smart.
Yeah. It's also important because that's shareable content. I mean, if I get an end-of-the-year gift appeal, a letter, I'm unlikely to take that to my neighbor and say, hey, look at this letter I got. And I certainly wouldn't share it with 400 of my friends. But if I give a donation to your organization, and I think it's a really great organization like Heifer, I could share that video and say, here's what I'm giving for people, or you want to give me a gift, you know, buy me a flock of, goats, or
yeah.
I guess not a flock,
a flock of sheep. My world and welcome to it.
But if you said buy me a flock of goats, you would get
you
people's
might.
Attention.
People might choose to do that. So I mean, it allows you to spread the message, and that's part of what nonprofits are looking
and
for.
And they have a really smart concept. What is the other organization that's doing, micro giving?
So another organization that's similar but slightly different is Kiva.org, and listeners may be familiar with this one. This is about microfinancing, where very small loans are given to help people create sustainable businesses. You can go online and you can pick, again, very specifically, what kind of project. So if you're a big coffee drinker, maybe you want to support a coffee farmer in Guatemala. You can put $25 toward that loan. When that loan gets repaid, you get your $25 back, and you can credit that towards another project if you wish. And so it's,
yeah,
you know,
it's just a great way to have a gift that keeps on giving. And or if you're a big coffee drinker, Anne, I can say, I gave this on your behalf for Christmas. Which feels really cool, I think, and unusual, and I would be really appreciative of a gift like that. Well, how thoughtful.
You know, and with the stuff that comes through the mail, they have the boxes you can check. Mm-hmm. And I know that they never say just give a $10. That's always
right.
Much more because they have to justify the printing and the postage and all this stuff and pay all the overhead for that. There's no overheads such as we know it to a certain extent.
I wouldn't say
managing
that.
The pages.
Yeah.
There is. I mean, you know, with the transfer of money, there's always costs involved. part of what you're getting through going through some of these marketplaces of nonprofits, another one we'll mention is globalgiving.org. Mm-hmm. It's a really good example because they fund projects all over the world, and often it's very small grassroots projects, which are often the most effective. What Global Giving does is vet all of those projects. So when you give your money, you have security. In fact, they give you a guarantee. You know, you will get your money back if you're not satisfied with how that project proved to you their funds were being used. And so you can give with some security. But there's some costs in that.
Yeah, that
so there's an overhead
and
fee. And, you know, it's an elaborate website, and there's some cost to that. So there is some cost with doing this, but there's benefits to the donors, partly because now you can discover an entire world of giving opportunities that otherwise would have been very hard to find.
And we had a caller that wanted to know how far you can track your donation to online charities.
Well, you know, that's another thing that's useful about this is, of course, often there's much more transparency because there are records and digital trails, and that in this day and age, accountability is such an important word for nonprofits that all the organizations we've talked about today have very high standards of accountability. But if you have concerns, we'll just mention yet one more website. There is a website for you called GuideStar. And if you go to GuideStar, that is basically a review site for nonprofits. So if you get a solicitation and you're not really sure if this is a viable nonprofit or if they're registered or how they use their money, you can go to GuideStar, look at the reviews, look at their financials, look at their past history, and make a more informed judgment. So we, in some sense, we have much more information than ever before about the folks who are asking us for money.
And I think we've always been concerned about that. Sometimes, you know, lately, last week, I've pulled up at red lights and there are people there with buckets, you know, and they want you to give money and you just aren't sure. Where does the money go? What's the overhead? What are they paying the people to collect the money? And it's great to have places to go where you can make more informed decisions. Of course, you can never guarantee any of these. There could be someone doing something they shouldn't be doing somewhere.
That's true of anything.
Mm-hmm. But there are ways that you can do research now that help you feel more secure. You can never feel completely secure with any money that you're donating, but it can help you feel more secure. And there are a lot of organizations now doing a tremendous amount of reporting out about how the money's being spent, what good has been accomplished.
Yeah, and some of that's fun, like Donors Choose, to go back to the classroom projects. If you give to that project, if you give a certain amount, then the class will write you letters. So you get letters and pictures from the classroom of what a difference that made, and that's really heartwarming as a donor.
And if you're really big in music in schools, this is a way to very, very, very specifically target. You
or
go
anything.
To the section that where they want musical instruments or where they're looking, you know, that kind of a thing.
We saw a classroom get all kinds of chess sets, and it was from a guy who really thinks chess is important and really helps, you know, develop the pathways in your brain and really helps you become smarter. And they had asked for chess sets, and he made the donation. So there's whatever you care about, if you want kids to get involved in that, there's likely a classroom looking for that very thing.
It's amazing. The Charles Best, a teacher at a public high school in the Bronx, started that DonorsChoose.org in 2000. And since then, it's grown to serve all the public schools throughout the United States. And as of August, this past August, more than $86 million has been donated to more than 210,000 projects, mm-hmm. helping more than 5.1 million students.
That is amazing.
That's amazing.
Great figures. You're seeing, you know, all kinds of folks and non-folks being helped. I mean, you look at the Humane Society. They've done a tremendous job of raising money via social media. And, of course, social media is a great place to post those really cute dog photos and say, help us raise money.
I'm a sucker.
I am, too. I'm a real sucker for cute dog photos and, you know, for helping out homeless animals and all kinds of
Sparky
things.
Sparky just found his forever home. And then the next thing, an hour later, I'm still in the site looking at everyone else who found their forever home.
Yes, it's awesome. So we're helping people do all kinds of things, from build wells to save animals, to get, you know, classrooms equipped. I mean, really, social media is playing an increasing role in helping raise money for all kinds of great good causes.
And, of course, that's all still tax deductible. It's coming to the end of the year. If you're thinking about charitable giving, consider social media as one of your options out there. Deborah Jasper, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Ann. It's always fun.
It is. And Betsy Hubbard, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ann.
Betsy Hubbard and Deborah Jasper, both digital media consultants and co-founders of Mindset Digital. When we return, Steve Fox joins us from PC World to talk about something. I'll try to figure it out between now and then. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The number of students getting free school meals has been on a sharp uptick in recent years, a symptom of these tough economic times. As the holidays approach, many children may realize for the first time that they're poor. I'm Neil Conan, Children and Poverty, plus an exit interview, former Medicare Administrator Donald Berwick. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 39 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today, a high of 46. Rain moving into the area tonight, a low of 36 degrees. More rain for Wednesday, a high of 54, and expect rain again Wednesday night, a low of 50 degrees.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment managers providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life at sherringtongroup.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher, Tech Tuesday continues on 89.7 NPR News.
PC World surveyed their readers to rate products according to reliability and consumer satisfaction. Joining us now to talk about that is Steve Fox. He's the editorial director of PC World in San Francisco, where he oversees editorial content and strategy for PCWorld.com and PC World Magazine. Welcome back, Steve.
Great to be back.
Listeners, if you want to see the results of the survey, you can go to PCWorld.com and check out their website. We'll have a link at our website as well at WOSU.org/allsides. And so, Steve, tell us about the survey. More than 63,000 PC World readers responded.
Yeah, we reach out to our readers. We do this every year. We've been doing it for, I don't know, probably about 20 years now. And we ask them, essentially, what are your experiences with the technology you have with the various devices? And we ask them to specifically respond to products that they currently own or have owned very recently. And we ask them just a slew of questions, you know, did it arrive okay? Did it break? What kind of service did you have? And so on and so forth. And what it gives us is a, you know, yearly moving snapshot of how people feel about the tech that they own, you know, in terms of how reliable is it and the rest.
Any general trends as far as between the different technologies, between, you know, between computers, say, and digital cameras? I mean, are people more satisfied with their cameras than their computers, or do you not look at it that way?
Well, no, I mean, and we do, and in general, computers, well, people these days are pretty satisfied with a lot of things like cameras. Mm-hmm. I think as far as, you know, computers themselves, you know, they do tend to break. Things do go wrong with them. It doesn't necessarily affect people's satisfaction. What really gets people is when things arrive and they're, you know, dead on arrival or they can't get them fixed. Like, one of the big categories that we look at right now is smartphones. And since everyone's got a phone and many, many people have smartphones, we get a huge number of responses on that. I would say the takeaway from the entire survey is right now it's good to be Apple. As a matter of fact, it's probably good to be Apple in a number of categories, but at smartphones, the iPhone is very much at the top of the satisfaction list right now.
It's a self-selecting survey.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we had 63,000 people, but we essentially advertise and say, if you want to take the survey, you have some technology, sign up. You might win some sort of a gift that we give as incentive. So yes, there is that self-selectivity. The other point here is these are primarily readers of PC World, so they're techie folks. It's people who kind of know what is going on in the world of technology. So that really helps in terms of answering the questions because they get quite specific at certain points.
They actually know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's helpful. We also ask things like what broke. I mean, this was interesting. In smartphones, we ask, you know, if something went wrong, what was it? And, you know, number one was the operating system, and number two was the touchscreen. I think many of us have seen broken touchscreens and know what that is. Battery is also up there as the number two thing that has a problem. All the way down to things like the actual physical keyboard is the lowest reported incidence, that in PowerPort. So we really get a sense of that. And some things come through quite clearly. We found that in smartphones, again, 3 out of 4 of the of smartphones reported trouble-free. So 75% of the people said no trouble with their smartphones. Of course, you could say, well, that means, you know, 1 in 4 had trouble. And what's kind of more shocking, of those 1 in 4, 2 out of 5 people said they never got the problem resolved to their satisfaction. So it's actually a pretty big number. So there are problems with a lot of the technology that we have, and some of them may be there certainly can be user error that's part of it, but clearly they're not as reliable. None of these are as reliable as we'd like to see.
My guest is Steve Fox, Editorial Director and Vice President of PC World. We're talking about customer satisfaction for tech products. If you have a question or comment for Steve, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. To what extent did you survey on actual customer service?
Well, we ask about customer service on all the categories. If we don't get at least 500 responses in any category for any brand, we don't report on it. So because it's a subset of a subset, by the time you get to service, we don't get quite as many responses. However, in areas like smartphones and laptops, where there are, you know, huge numbers of buyers, we do get to see, you know, who does well there. And again, Apple does very, very well in service. However, there are some other players here who do quite well also. I mean, for instance, it's kind of interesting we're talking about Apple, but in the cameras category, you have Canon, who is basically almost as dominant. You see that their numbers are just extraordinarily good across the board, which is, you know, obviously a very good thing if you happen to be Canon. And then, you know, we also looked at things like HDTVs, and there you can really see an interesting, what feels like a horse race. There are something like 16 categories or 16 brands of people offering HDTVs, which is huge. No mm-hmm. other category is anywhere near that big. And there, LG is actually at the top of the list.
Pioneer, Samsung, Toshiba, Vizio, Philips, Mitsubishi. Do you cover them all, or does everybody make it on the list?
Well, no, we actually put it's even a larger list that goes out,
okay.
But we only include any of the brands that get enough votes to make it on this list. So what it means is that all of those TVs, for instance, had more than 500 users apiece. You know, that's where you get to some for our size of the model, that's where you get to statistical significance, which is what we need. Then again, in cameras, you know, it's more like 8 or 9 brands, something like that. And then a couple other things might really jump out at people. I mean, we look at printers, and I should mention, since we've been doing this for a long time, we have what you could consider, a lot of history in this, and we can really see movements. And, you know, what we see right now is at the top on printers, Brother has done just a remarkable job on reliability. Canon and Samsung are all right at the top. You know, most of us would think, oh, that would have to be HP. But no, actually, HP is near the bottom. So these are kind of some of these are surprising or maybe even counterintuitive, but they're movements that we've seen happen slowly over the years. And it's actually very good to be able to see some confirmation because this happens year over year. You can really see this kind of movement.
We are talking about PC World's survey. They survey their readers to rate products according to reliability and consumer satisfaction. You can go to PCWorld.com. Go to their website and check out the survey there. You can also check it out at our get to that link via WOSU.org/allsides. You can also give us a call right now and talk to Steve Fox, Editorial Director and Vice President of PC World. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we have a tweet right now from Michelle. What were some of the best cameras again? You said Canon. Anything more specific? I know Nikon.
Yeah. So let me. I'll just pull those numbers out. I have most of them kind of at the tip of my fingers. So here we go. Canon was basically top across the board. Panasonic was in second place for cameras. By the way, we also broke it down, which are easiest to use, and the winner for easiest to use, which is obviously an important measure, would be Pentax and Kodak. Hmm. The ones that are considered hardest to use would be Fujifilm, Olympus, and Nikon. Now, this is just a lot of this also relates to just the sheer number of features. Best warranty would be Nikon and Canon. The lowest there would be Kodak. So picture quality, which I think is probably, for most of us right at the top, there you're talking Nikon and Canon. So these are all really, very strong players in the field. But, frankly, in cameras, I think there's a little more consistency than in many of the categories. The top five or six all really do quite well. Actually, let's see, Canon, Panasonic, GE, Casio, Nikon, Olympus, and Pentax, really all the way down to Samsung, have really quite good stores in Fujifilm. So there are no real losers in that category. Some of the other categories we looked at, the folks at the bottom have just terrible scores. We look at laptops, for instance, and here, once again, as I mentioned, it's good to be Apple. Well, it's very good to be Apple if you're selling laptops.
Mm-hmm.
But, Samsung and Toshiba and Asus do very, very well in this category. Similarly, I mean, at the other end of the scale, a lot of the Dell machines, specifically Dell for Home, really do not do well in terms of reliability. There are problems on arrival. There are significant problems. There are, failed components. So this is obviously a problem for Dell. They do much better with their Dell for Business line than with their Dell for Home line.
Tim in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Tim in Clintonville. I'm sorry. Welcome.
Yes, thank you for your time as always. Just wanted to give examples of the kind of two ends of the spectrum in terms of reliability. You just mentioned laptop computers. I had a Toshiba laptop, which was probably at least midline and maybe below that. I've had for over 6 years now, and I use it every day, and it's been fine. Hopefully, it will continue to be. The other end, I just purchased Micro Cruise brand 7-inch tablet. It lasted one day.
Right.
I bought it on Sunday, took it back on Monday because it just quit working.
Well, the interesting thing here is that Toshiba, of course, pretty much invented the category. They were not the first, but they were right there, and they're considered the granddad of that category. And they have continued over the years to make very solid, very consistent machines. We actually hear from lots of people who have Toshibas that are, by today's standards, ancient, and they're still working just fine. So there are smaller brands. I mean, the one that surprised me, and we actually like the Sony machines that we get in that PC world in terms of testing, and yet, from readers' point of view, they did not do nearly as well this year as we had expected. So even some top brands have some problems when you're talking about things like laptops. They are prone to breakage. This does happen, and reliability can be a problem.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Tim.
Sure. Another interesting category that we looked at that is we know will change hugely will be tablets. When we look at this next year, I expect that that we'll see some very different results. Clearly, at this point, it's still early in the tablet revolution, and there is just a dominant player, and that is the iPad. And Apple, of course, shows top scores, and everybody else is much, much lower. But since this survey was sent out and compiled, we've seen, new tablets. First of all, these lower-priced tablets from, people like Barnes & Noble with the Nook tablet. There's an Asus Transformer Prime, which is supposed to come out either this week or next week, which looks absolutely fabulous, and we're definitely excited about. You'll see the Amazon Kindle Fire at $200. May have some issues, but, much less expensive. So I actually am really looking forward to seeing how this category itself will change. Right now, it's basically Apple and the seven dwarfs is what it looks like. But I'm hoping that will change.
You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I have a sense that a lot of the market for the tablets is different than what it is for the PCs. In other words, there's going to be a lot of people, like my mom, who might get a tablet that would never have a PC because she couldn't handle all the hardware and all the rigmarole. But a tablet seems really easy, and I'm kind of interested to see how that pans out in terms of surveys and customer satisfaction and that sort of thing.
Well, I think the thing to watch there, because you're absolutely right, is that there may be some more people getting it who are perhaps less technically sophisticated. Mm-hmm. So what becomes most important is it just has to be absolutely brain-dead simple. And I'm not talking about for your mom. I don't know her personally. I know if it were my mom, it would have to really be brain-dead simple.
No comment. She might be listening.
Okay. Well, I'm sure she's great on the tablet. But so what you're going to see is, if they don't work really simply, if they don't turn on instantly, which most of these do, if you have to actually think about how this would work, they're going to get some pretty bad scores because, you know, people who are used to using computers, they kind of know how to do troubleshooting, or they understand a lot of the underlying metaphors of computing. So I think actually simplicity, and here's where Apple does very well, simplicity is the thing that will score best on these surveys. But, you know, it's very hard to figure out, even from a survey this complex, how much of this is an actual problem with the manufacturer and how much is, you know, what we think of as user error. In fact, over the years, what we've come to conclude is it doesn't matter. If people can't figure out how to do it, you know, sure, you can say, well, that's user error, but actually it's a manufacturer problem, because if you haven't made it simple enough for people, that's going to work against you.
So any big surprises for you, Steve Fox?
Well, I think the strength at this point of, say, Brother within printers is a big deal. I also think that, as I look at things like desktops, Asus, which, you know, not that many years ago, no one took all that seriously. You know, they'd come out with a really small, laptop netbook and things like that. Asus looks to be a real force and has done very well, for instance, in desktops. So I think that's the surprising part. I think the overall surprise is that no one for the last maybe 3 or 4 years has been able to make a dent in the satisfaction people feel with Apple, and in being able to creep up on them. You know, it's not like the folks in the PC universe haven't had time to go to school on everything Apple is doing,
mm-hmm.
and yet we still do not see anyone really approaching the kind of scores that Apple gets really across the board in, you know, three different categories where they dominate.
I would imagine that going to see these survey results would be a good idea for people going out to buy Christmas presents right now.
Because, you know, you really do want to get something that's not going to break. And because we break it down into, you know, which are easiest to use, mm-hmm. which have the best warranty, you can actually figure out and do some calibration as you're doing your gift giving, and sometimes those might even be for yourself. This is a guide. It's one of many things that we look at and we expect people to look at when they make purchases. For some of the more complicated products, say in the camera range, you really want to know who it is you're buying for. If this is someone who's very comfortable with cameras and understands what they're doing, then it's fine to get something that's not as easy to use because, you know, to begin with, they're just more complex. Right?
Do you get into price so that people can price compare too at the same time? Because sometimes you're willing to give up a little customer satisfaction if you can't afford it.
Absolutely. So this survey, except in the laptop category where we do ask them, about value, this one is really meant to look strictly at satisfaction at performance, reliability, and the like.
Okay.
We do have a few questions in there about, you know, do you feel you got a good deal? But, you know, we have all other kinds of things on the site that give prices and the like that allow you to make those decisions on your own. But this one really focuses on satisfaction.
Okay. Steve Fox, thanks for joining us again.
This was fun.
Appreciate it. Steve Fox, he's editorial director and vice president of PC World. Coming up, Russell Holley from Geek.com. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, comic Louis C.K. talks about some of the real experiences he's drawn on for his stand-up comedy and his FX series, Louis. Time magazine just named Louis the best TV show of the year. GQ named Louis C.K. the comic genius of the year. He has a new stand-up comedy special that he's decided to make available only on his website. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Get daily updates from the WOSU newsroom by signing up for our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up. You can also connect with our news team by following WOSU News on Twitter or like our station on Facebook.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories on 89.7 come from the law firm of Porter, Wright, Morris, and Arthur LLP, helping businesses and individuals solve complex legal problems throughout Ohio, across the country, and around the world. On the web at porterwright.com.
Join us for All Sides tomorrow from 10 until noon, a discussion of the proposed sculpture downtown at the Scioto Mile and also the value of public art. And then in the second hour, an update on Ohio political news with a panel of State House reporters. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 until noon tomorrow on 89.7 NPR News. Partly sunny skies today, a high of 46, rain likely tonight. And All Sides continues on 89.7.
Today on Tech Tuesday, the operating system you've all been hearing about for the past several months, Windows has been previewing Windows 8, getting ready for the launch of Windows 8 beta code in February, with the actual launch of Windows 8 operating system at least a year away. What do we need to know and what should we be looking forward to? Joining us now is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome back to the show, Russell.
Thanks for having me back, Ann.
And everybody out there, questions, comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What's Windows 8, and who's going to be testing Windows 8 beta code starting in February?
So Windows 8 is the next iteration of the Windows operating system. Everybody right now, you know, is slowly making that move to Windows 7, mm-hmm. and Microsoft is, you know, they have a team dedicated on keeping Windows 7, you know, up to date and making sure that it works well. But they also have an entirely different group of people working on the next version, which is due to be released sometime late next year. And the beta that's going to be coming out in February is really geared towards people who are going to be developing applications for the new look and feel of Windows 8. Because Windows 8 is going to be a little different than how we know Windows now.
Like how?
So there's been a couple of attempts in the last, you know, really the last 5 years, but more so in the last 2 years, where different hardware manufacturers have tried to make Windows computers, desktops, and laptops that you can touch. These touchscreen computers, you know, before the iPad craze, before the smartphone craze, you know, these machines were, you know, Windows computers that you could touch and move things around. And the problem was that Windows really isn't built to do that. You know, the X button's is too small for your finger when you try to close a window. Scrolling things is significantly less natural than it feels on something like an iPad. So the Windows operating system never really took to that hardware design, and those devices never really sold very well. Microsoft is building Windows 8 to include support for those kind of devices. It's not a complete redesign. Your Windows, as you know, it is still there, that desktop with your applications and stuff, but you're going to be able to use it a lot more friendly with your finger. It's designed to be a touch-driven interface as well as with your mouse and keyboard.
Murph in Grove City, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Murph.
How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I have a business partner that wants to convert our computers to Apple. we've got all Windows software. And many years ago, I had a friend that tried to do that, and geez, he ended up buying two or three different kinds of software to do conversion and all that nonsense. Is it pretty transparent now?
Well, it really depends on what kind of business you have and what applications you're using. If your applications are still, you know, very Windows-specific, then you're going to run into a lot of the same problems still today.
Okay, Murph?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is conversion software available?
No, just the applications tend to run on both platforms now.
Oh, okay. So it's not seamless, but it should be pretty easy to fix.
It gets easier with a lot of applications, but there are still some, you know, particularly financial applications that are still very specific to one operating system or the other. It would really depend on what software you're using.
What about Excel?
Well, Microsoft Office works just the same on Windows as it does on Apple. So all of the Office products work the same.
Okay.
All right.
All right,
Thanks.
Murph. Yep, good
Thank
luck.
You.
Yep. 614-292-8513. That is the number to call if you'd like to speak to our guest right now, Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. We're talking about Windows 8. It's coming up next year. It's getting field tested, I guess, starting in February. If you want to know about it, more about it, questions or comments, give us a call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page and you can tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. So you're saying that for now you'll be able to use the conventional mouse click and the touch.
The operating system would work for both of these, you know, so that they can fit on a variety of different hardware types without having to look different on each one.
Is the day coming when we'll just lose the mouse?
There's a lot of speculation to that. I think it's a use case issue. There are a lot of people who are perfectly comfortable reaching out and touching their computer and moving it around. And with laptops, we've kind of replaced the mouse with a touchpad for a lot of people. And the touching the little square on the screen and touching the screen itself is really not as far a leap as a lot of people would believe. It's really hard to say. I think that there will be specific use cases where the mouse will be relevant for quite a while, but I wouldn't be surprised if in the next couple of years we start to see that particular piece of technology start to go away.
I don't know. The touchpad, sometimes I feel like I'm twisting my finger into a knot trying to get it to go where I want.
You definitely have to have a high-quality touchpad in order for it to be any kind of replacement for a mouse, but they do exist.
On your blog, you did a demonstration of Windows 8 using EXOPC Slate.
Right.
Well, this has got all kinds. But tell us about how it worked. What was your conclusion? And tell us what you did.
So this was not the hardware that this operating system was built for. It was significantly less powerful than the hardware that it was demonstrated on when Windows 8 was originally unveiled. And my purpose there was to demonstrate that it, you know, how effective Windows 8 was going to be on less than optimal hardware, because the stuff that Microsoft brought out on stage, they never released the price for that tablet computer that they showed, but the hardware that was in it suggested that it would be pretty expensive. So I wanted to show it on a machine that was less than $500 that, you know, somebody could go and buy and set up, you know, right now. And the XOPC Slate is a device that I've enjoyed for a while, you know, specifically because of that. Windows 8 ran really well as far as navigation and, you know, being able to use it as a computer. A lot of the things that were built into it didn't work so well at first. It has a camera built into the front that Windows didn't recognize. But there have been updates since that video that I made that, you know, allowed it to recognize the camera and the speakers and things like that. And now it's an extremely smooth, you know, computing experience.
When Windows is previewing this, as I said earlier, Windows 8 beta code in February. What does that involve? How many people are working on it? How do they test these things?
Well, the biggest thing is to reach out to Microsoft's developer community, which is massive. I mean, hundreds of thousands of developers all across the world who will all take, you know, this software, install it on test machines that they have, and either build new applications or take their existing applications and make them work with, you know, this new application. So it is a massive user base of developers who are going to be, you know, testing every nook and cranny of the operating system to make sure that it works great, because it's not just making sure that it works great for Windows, but it's making sure that their applications look good as well.
When they make these predictions that they're coming out with this next year, to what extent, I mean, do they force the issue when they set a date like that instead of coming up with it, fixing it, making sure it's all working, and then telling people when it's going to come out?
Well, when they set these kind of projections, they're based on, you know, demonstration time that they set up for testing and things like that, but they also have some padding involved there to make sure that things like that don't happen. I mean, the unveiling for, you know, Windows 8 is probably, you know, I wouldn't say exactly a year, but probably closer to 9 months away, you know, right now. And I use it every day, you know, and not just on the ExoPC slate. I have it on a traditional computer as well, you know, to see how it works. And I very, very rarely run into any problems. I mean, it's very stable already. So by the time it actually comes out, you know, I think that time projection was, you know, was built with that in mind.
My guest is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. He's going to be with us for about another 8 or 9 minutes. So get your calls in if you have a question about Windows 8 or about Windows in general, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go on to our Facebook page as well if you want to communicate that way. One issue you raised in your blog is the balance necessary for Windows 8 to serve both the technical user, you, and the consumer, me. If the system is too limiting, it becomes useless to the technical user. If it's too complicated for the general user, it won't succeed. So where's that balance going to end up at?
Well, it's an important balance to keep in mind, and I think that Microsoft has done a pretty good job of it so far. The problem that we run into with these operating systems that we have on tablets right now, you know, the iPad and you know, the Android tablets and the Kindle Fire, these are all great single-use devices. If you want to browse the web or listen to music or, you know, do things like that, then they're really great devices to, you know, sit on an airplane or sit in the living room. But you can't, or it's not nearly as comfortable to, you know, write a paper, or, you know, if you're a programmer, you can't really use these devices to do those things. And so I appreciate Windows 8 a whole lot more than I appreciate an iPad or an Android tablet, because it's all of Windows. It's not, you know, it's not like, you know, with the iPad where it's a part of, you know, Apple's operating system. It's the entire platform. And that's a really significant thing to have when you want to do things that aren't, you know, bound to a single app.
And so generally, it sounds like you're pretty positive about this. You think it's going to be a good thing.
This is definitely the first version of Windows that I've been 100% happy with from the time I've installed it.
What's been your worst experience with Windows?
I was an actual developer tester for Windows Vista before it came out.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a 6 month period where we had to, you know, review Windows Vista and submit fixes. And the problem that I had with that was that Windows Vista was actually really functional in certain areas during that 6 month period, but it then got some critical features got ripped out of it before it got sent out, and it caused a lot of other problems. And that's a big part of why Windows Vista wasn't as polished as it should have been when it came out.
Brett in Delaware, you're on the air with Russell Holley. Welcome to the show, Brett.
Hey, thanks. I have a couple questions. Besides hover cars, I don't know if you have an answer to that, but actually I was wondering about the integration with our television, how soon that's going to happen, or, you know, it seems like that should have happened a little bit more by now.
You mean as far as Windows integrating with the television?
You know, computers in general, I guess. You know, our computers with the internet, with our television, with cable TV, and that sort of thing. I mean, I know you can link them up and you can watch, you know, movies from the internet on your television now, but it seems like it should have been more seamlessly integrated by now. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Oh, well, I definitely agree that I wish that we were a little further along in that right now. And each one of these three major tech companies, you know, Google, Microsoft, and Apple, they each have an attempt in the market right now to try and bring their services to the television. You know, the Google TV devices that are on the market today with the Logitech Review and some of the Sony TVs that have it built in, Apple's Apple TV device, and actually the most recent update to the Xbox 360 with the Kinect, each provide a really great, you know, home experience where you can tie in some of your computer services or your web services to your television. And I think that over the next year, we're going to see a whole lot more focused on, you know, the biggest screen in our house, getting a lot more attention as far as, you know, these computer-like services being added to it.
Brett?
Great.
Okay.
No word on the hover car then either.
No word on the hover car.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I want my jetpack. We were just talking to our kid, what's in the future when we were growing up, was the jetpack. We were all going to have a jetpack by 2012.
Absolutely.
You last week suggested the Xbox Kinect, as a matter of fact, as your latest, greatest idea for Christmas gifts, about $99, pretty affordable for most people, or for a lot of people, I should say. What about this week? What else are you looking at for Christmas?
This week, you know, if you're getting an Xbox, make sure that you have the Kinect. I can't stress that enough, especially with the Microsoft just got an update to the Xbox this past week that allows some really cool things as far as being able to sit on your couch and actually talk to your television and have it, you know, like open Netflix and you know, do things that are a lot more than just the, you know, the basic television.
You mean with Kinect?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, the update that allows you to do that is really just extremely functional, being able to sit on your couch and actually talk to your television to accomplish things. But this week, I think the biggest thing that I wanted to talk about, you know, outside of you know, the little bit that we covered today, was some of the things that I've seen with, you know, the little tiny gadgets that you can get for your phone and you know, these little accessories. There's a couple of companies right now that are working on these styluses for your phone, you know, if you have a smartphone, an iPhone or an Android phone,
mm-hmm.
because we're getting a lot colder. I don't know. I mean, here in Maryland, we're getting a lot colder. I can only assume you guys are dealing with some cold weather
yeah.
in Ohio
mm-hmm.
right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to get any better, I've been told. So these styluses actually make it so that you can interact with your phone without having to take your gloves off.
Okay. Kind
I mean,
of like
most
a,
of
the,
these are,
like the old BlackBerry stylus or not BlackBerry,
well,
but the... I can't remember what it was called now.
Like the Palm style.
The Palm these, Palm Pilot thing, yeah.
Yeah, these have a gel tip, and they're actually much smaller, and they have a little adapter that snaps into the headphone jack of your phone. They're very small. They're incredibly light, and they're not invasive in any way. And you can use them, you know, with anything. You can use them with your gloves on and do anything like that. So there's no reason to take your gloves off to use your phone. And that I think is going to be very important to a lot of people who are going to be, you know, especially new people using their smartphones for the first time.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, I have a hard time using the smartphone, my fingers. I mean, it's like you have to have a stylus for a fingertip or something. It feels like it.
Sometimes, yeah.
Well, Russell Holly, tech blogger for geek.com, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
I'm glad to be back.
And, hopefully next week, something new. Again, thanks to everybody for listening. Just want to say thanks to my All-Side staff as well, my producer Linda Taylor, associate producer Amy Jurevich, All-Side's production assistant Jennifer Monroe left us, All-Side's intern Corinne Gleckler, and All-Side's volunteers Ian Sheik and Rose Joe. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1. Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.